off, that ad funding model becomes much more challenging. So I think for most publishers, you're going to see a future of a mixed revenue model. So some readers paying who want the whole package, who will become subscribers and loyal readers. And you will then see some syndicated content, i.e., so certain articles appearing in different platforms like Apple News, and other environments where those environments are paying almost sort of article by article basis, and getting a share of revenue in that way. I hope we will get to a settlement where AI developers will pay the rightful premium due for premium content that they are ingesting to news publishers. And we hope that there will be a continued advertising revenue because news media environments and published trusted environments offer a really rich environment for people to advertise and get real exposure for their products and services.
Thank you, Owen Meredith, who's Chief Executive of the News Media Association. Well, thank you so much for your company this afternoon. My producer was Lizzie Highfield and Ryan Boyden was pressing the buttons. I'm back tomorrow from 1 o'clock. Jane Garvey is here next on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
A very good afternoon. It is 2 o'clock. This is Jane Garvey. I'm here until 4 o'clock on Times Radio. And in the next couple of hours, a virtual summit with President Trump and a whole host of other world leaders, including President Zelensky, is about to get underway. We'll try to keep you up to speed with that. What about this as a method of dealing with catcallers? Female police officers go out jogging undercover. And my big guest today after 3:30 is Nicola Sturgeon, the former First Minister of Scotland. Let's start with the news at 2. Here's Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Keir Starmer is preparing a fresh round of sanctions to impose on Russia if President Trump concludes President Putin isn't serious about Ukraine peace talks. The Prime Minister will attempt to coordinate international pressure on Russia as he joins a German-led virtual summit. European leaders are seeking to reach a joint position, then press their case to Trump when he joins the call before his meeting with the Russian leader. The Times' Nick Allipour is in Berlin and explains what's behind these meetings.
It's basically Europe's attempt to secure a seat at the table without actually having a seat at the table. The nightmare scenario, obviously, for Europe is that Putin will manage to seduce Trump again to come down on Russia's side more than he has in the past. You know, mind you, it's been really difficult, hard, incremental work for European leaders to actually get Trump to take a tougher line on Russia.
A 16-year-old girl and two teenage boys have been charged with the murder of a man who was found dead on the Isle of Sheppey in Kent. The body of 49-year-old Alexander Cashford was discovered by police on Sunday night. Police will be encouraged to tell the public the nationalities and ethnicities of suspects when they're charged in high-profile cases. The National Police Chiefs Council says it's to reduce the risk to public safety where there are high levels of misinformation. The average two-year mortgage rate has dipped below 5% for the first time since former Prime Minister Liz Truss's mini-budget. Moneyfacts says it's dropped to 4.99%. The financial groups described it as a symbolic turning point and shows lenders are competing more aggressively. The founder and CEO of Octopus Energy has told Times Radio the government risks a 1970s-style malaise on net zero. Greg Jackson says the biggest wind farm gets paid 71% of the time to not generate, which could cost the taxpayer £8 billion a year by 2030.
The answer is not to stop building wind turbines and solar farms, is to build them in the right places, and it's to introduce the right mechanisms that mean that instead of companies benefiting, like literally having a business plan to build wind turbines that are going to get turned off, they're instead incentivized to build them where they're going to get used all the time when it's windy to generate cheap electricity. So consumers benefit. Until we reform the market, consumers are paying the price.
He's called for a market reform in the mould of states like Texas, which pays considerably less than the UK for its electricity. And Nicola Sturgeon has told Times Radio the SNP needs to do more to counter the threat of reform at next year's Scottish elections. The former SNP First Minister has been speaking ahead of the publication of her autobiography. She says Nigel Farage's opponents can't afford to stand still.
I'm really concerned about the rise of reform, and I think there needs to be more than a rhetorical sort of riposte to reform in Nigel Farage. There needs to be a substantive response from, you know, progressive politicians, whether that's my party or Labour or the Liberals. But reformers speaking to a constituency of people who are not seeing the answers to the problems they perceive in more mainstream politicians. And I think that's a concern for all of us.
The full interview can be heard on Times Radio at 3:30 this afternoon or on the Off Air on Off Air with Jane and Fee podcast. And remember, our news podcast on the Times Radio app. Look for the Times News Briefing and the World in 10.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Hello, good afternoon. It is Jane Garvey on Times Radio until 4 o'clock. Looking forward to the next couple of hours. I hope I can rely on your company to drag ourselves through the afternoon together. It's August. 0333 003 2353 is the WhatsApp number. We have got some good stuff actually coming your way on Times Radio in the next couple of hours. Baroness Claire Fox on how she thinks free speech is faring in Britain right now. We'll talk about the undercover police joggers looking for catcallers. We'll talk to the country's leading TV critic, the brilliant Scott Bryan, on the new lineup for Match of the Day, the new presenting lineup, that is. The eager beavers who've signed up for this year's Strictly. As ever, you won't have heard of any of them, but then you will find yourself absolutely falling in love with at least two of them and watching every single episode with a glass of Prosecco in your hand come the autumn. And we'll also talk about the ITV drama set around Loch Ness that's a huge hit now on Netflix, but it was made and first shown back in 2017. Why does that keep happening? We'll talk tech with Chris Stokel-Walker. Have you deleted your old emails and photos to help the Environment Agency save water? We'll talk about the rivalry between Sam Altman and Elon Musk about bringing computers and humans together and the increased use of police facial recognition vans. But the big interview, you've already heard about it in the news at 2 o'clock, is with the former Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, talking about her memoir, Frankly. There's a lot in the book, there really is. And here's just a snippet of the interview. In this bit, she's discussing her predecessor, Alex Salmond.
I've tried not to rewrite history. He was my mentor. He was a very close friend. It's for others to judge, but I would say we were one of the most successful political partnerships in recent British political history. So a lot of my successes, not all of them, but a lot of them, he is integrally involved in and deserves the credit as much as I do. But he was a tough person to work for.
Yes, there's a lot about Alex Salmond in that interview, but she also talks about other things, her view of what it was like to work up to a point alongside Boris Johnson, particularly during COVID. She talks too about that day when the police, just 8 days after she resigned as Scottish First Minister, came to the house she shared with her then husband, well, actually, they are still married, Peter Murrell, arrested Peter Murrell, and Nicola Sturgeon had to go off to stay with her mum and dad. That's just a week after she was leading the country. An extraordinary story. She says herself that the last couple of years in her life have been, quotes, torrid. So she has many admirers, and there are plenty of people who think negatively of Nicola Sturgeon, but I think she's interesting, and her book, frankly, is one of the more revealing political memoirs, no doubt about that. Now, to the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. At number three, Treasury considers inheritance tax raid in budget. Rachel Reeves has ruled out a wealth tax, meaning her officials are now looking at other solutions for the UK's budget problems. At number two, the US says human rights have worsened in Britain. That warning from the US State Department says that prosecutions of anti-abortion activists and some social media users are causing what they describe as a chilling effect. We'll talk about all that with Claire Fox a bit later in the programme. And the most read piece on the Times website is Meet the Oxbridge Graduates Who Can't Get, in brackets, a good, close brackets, job. This is a report on how a degree from one of our top universities no longer appears to be a passport to decent employment. You can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need your digital subscription, and you can get one if you don't have one by going to thetimes.com/subscribe. Now, the big news of the day, and it's happening right now. As we speak, European leaders are talking to Donald Trump ahead of his summit on Friday with Vladimir Putin. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, Keir Starmer, the German Chancellor and others are taking part in this call. They are desperate to keep the US President on side after the Ukrainians were left out of those talks with Russia. There was talk, I think, earlier in the week that perhaps President Zelensky might get a call up and might be asked to go to the meeting in Alaska. It doesn't appear to be happening that, though. Let's check in with Catherine Philp, who is the Times World Affairs editor. Was that true, actually, Catherine, that there was talk that Zelensky might be asked to take part?
I think it was fairly casual talk, to be honest, and it was in response to criticism that he was shut out of the process. And I think it was really rhetorical because Putin had never agreed to that and was never going to.
Right. OK, so what will be the message that the Europeans will attempt to deliver to Donald Trump today?
That they need to be part of this process, that Ukraine cannot be forced into making any concessions without its consent, and that really it can't be, these negotiations between Russia and America cannot take place over the head of the continent for whom they have the most resonance and risk.
And is there any indication that Donald Trump is in the mood to listen to that message?
Well, I wouldn't want to prejudge it. He will be taking part in that conversation today, and he's sort of hailed the Europeans as being as interested in him in stopping the war. So let's see. I think it's possibly not encouraging that J.D. Vance is going to be on that call. He's famously known for not, he has said he doesn't care what happens to Ukraine either way, and he is fairly rabidly anti-European. and we've seen, of course, from Zelensky's horrible encounter in the Oval Office with J.D. Vance and Trump that J.D. Vance is very, very capable of starting a fight. That Trump ends up having to finish. So that is concerning, I believe. I think it is instructive and useful that Zelensky has flown to Berlin to take part in this phone call, even though it's a remote conference, because he will literally be sitting side by side with the German Chancellor, and that's a powerful signal of European unity and those forces that are behind him and want him, his views on this to be respected.
What Europe does have in its favour is that the frozen Russian state assets. Now, as I understand it, some of the interest on those assets has been spent on Ukraine, on assisting Ukraine. Yeah. But there's quite a lot of money left. I mean, couldn't something be done about that?
It could. It's very legally complex. And one of the concerns when all these issues of unfreezing frozen assets and giving them away comes up, excuse me, is the future implications for investment in countries. Like the idea that that people may be put off from that this may not be legal, and two, that you may be putting off future investment in your own country. So that's always brings a moment of hesitation for leaders, I think.
But isn't this the time to dump the hesitation and be bold? In fact, Europe might have to be incredibly bold if there's a worst case scenario situation at the end of the week and Trump caves to Putin or just walks away and says, you know what, I'm not going to win the Nobel Peace Prize trying to end this war. It's never going to happen. I'm off. I mean, that's the worst case scenario, isn't it?
I think him walking away is actually not the worst case scenario, because he has already said, and I see no reason for him to break this particular promise. He's already said that Europe is perfectly permitted to buy American weapons and supply them to Ukraine. Now, I mean, I can only imagine that that's partly come about because of the lobbying from the very lucrative arms trade, the defense industries in the US, who don't want to lose this vital lifeline. Now, as long as Washington isn't paying for it, does it matter to him that Europe is buying American weapons? He would see that as a good thing. It readdresses the trade deficit. So if he walks away and takes himself out of it, so he no longer has influence, then the onus will be on Europe to step up. They may have to take a big decision on what they do with those frozen assets. But it's not possibly not as bad as Donald Trump staying in the game and yet caving to Putin and trying to force that upon the Europeans and the Ukrainians.
Right. It's interesting that when Donald Trump held a joint press conference with Putin at the Helsinki summit, that was back in 2018, it apparently went so badly that his then top Russia advisor, a British woman actually, or British-born woman called Fiona Hill, said she'd contemplated faking a seizure in an attempt to just end the whole thing. Now, it can't possibly go that badly on Friday, can it?
I don't know, Jane. I was at the Helsinki press conference and I wasn't working for Donald Trump. I was there as a journalist, but I actually know how Fiona Hill feels, because it was so jaw-dropping what we were witnessing. I can only imagine that she would have wanted to stop it in its tracks. I would hope that Trump has learned something from that experience. And also, I think that this meeting is going to take place in a very different atmosphere. At the time, he was still under this enormous pressure of this idea that there'd been Russian collusion. And so he allowed himself to be talked into into it by Putin, that obviously this was absurd, and he repudiated his own intelligence agencies in front of the world. Mm. But that was a lot to do with the personal pressure that he was under at the time. So I think absent that, there's a better chance for this than there was for Helsinki. But of course, the stakes in Helsinki were not as high as they are now.
No, and who is advising Donald Trump? Who's in the Fiona Hill role now? Because Stephen Witkoff travels the world, but he's a real estate man, isn't he?
He is indeed. And, if you think that the Middle East is a peace problem that has has tangled up so many incredibly experienced diplomats in the past and driven them mad. Witkoff has not only Ukraine, Russia to deal with, but also the intractable conflict in the Middle East. So that's a man with a lot on his plate and no experience whatsoever. There is no Fiona Hill anymore. There is no Fiona Hill who will be in the room at the press conference or advising Trump in the lead up to his encounter. There are no experts in this administration, and that is a problem.
Well, it's more than a problem. I mean, frankly, just to hear you say that, it's terrifying. Thank you for laying it out though, Catherine. Really appreciate it. I mean, briefly, do we expect to hear anything about this call today? Will we know what was discussed? Who said what?
I mean, I imagine that there will be statements. They may not resemble one another. It may be a question in the words of the late Queen that recollections may vary even right after the conversation. I would find it interesting. I will find it interesting to compare the different versions we hear from the different parties involved in those talks, because they will possibly have different things that they want to highlight from it. So, I would look at the gaps between them, and they may give us a clue as to where it goes on Friday. But I have to say that what's come out of the Kremlin today is very discouraging, because it doesn't resemble what Witkoff thinks he heard. It's right back to the maximalist claims that Putin made at the point of invasion, with absolutely no compromise.
Thank you, Catherine. That's Catherine Philp. Rather sobering account there from her about what is likely to unfold over the next couple of days. She's the Times World Affairs editor. You're listening to Times Radio, and why might you find yourself having to hum Staying Alive at the Bee Gees classic during a driving theory test? That's next. It's Times Radio. It's 18 minutes past two.
Tomorrow, more than 25,000 students will find out their A-level results. But are they as make or break as they used to be? And is the traditional university degree under threat? with vocational qualifications and apprenticeships on the rise. Listen to Times Radio as we analyse the changing face of education in Britain. Hear full coverage of A-Level Results Day throughout the day, tomorrow on Times Radio.
As a small business owner, you've got to be ready for the ups and the downs. Ready to think on your feet, ready to be rushed off your feet, ready to make the big decisions and make the tea. Two sugars in mind? Ta. Ready to be there for your customers whenever they need you. Well, ditto. Virgin Media Broadband's ready for anything business can throw at it. Yeah, it's business-ready broadband. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband.
Ah, claim approved. Direct Line's ready to send my new laptop within 2 hours. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like teaching little Johnny to play his recorder.
Oh, my.
That's my boy!
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Theft and accidental loss claims up to £3,000. Cover limits apply. Personal possessions cover needed for items outside the home.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Now, you might well have done a driving theory test, and now learner drivers are going to be asked about their life-saving skills as well as part of that test. The new questions on CPR and defibrillators will be added from early next year. The Times transport and travel correspondent is Ben Clatworthy. So what's the logic to this, Ben?
Good afternoon, Jane. Yes, the logic is that drivers are often the first on the scene when people are suffering cardiac arrest. That's if they're out walking. They could be on the pavement when they suffer the cardiac arrest. The idea is people in their cars are most likely to be the people who are there where their intervention could potentially save people's lives. The statistics are quite startling that actually if people immediately receive CPR and the use of a defibrillator, the chance of survival is 70%. Without it, it can be as low as 10%.
Right. I mean, that's incredibly significant statistics, those, aren't they? I'm ashamed to say that I probably wouldn't be able to answer these questions. Would you?
Well, the questions at the moment, it says that candidates from autumn of this year, theory test candidates will need to familiarise themselves with CPR techniques, including proper hand placement and compression rates, and also how to use automated external defibrillators. I think I know how to use the external defibrillator. I would probably be not so good on the CPR techniques. I last did it when I was at school, I think.
Right, OK. I mean, I didn't take a theory test. When did it come in?
Very good question, to which I do not know the answer.
Right. So I know that you can't take the actual practical exam until you've passed your theory. And lots of people actually struggle with the theory, never mind the practical, and it can take quite a while. And then your theory test, your pass, if you do pass it, is only valid for a certain amount of time, and you have to take the practical within that time span. Is there any evidence at all to suggest that driving standards have improved since everybody had to take the theory test?
So the theory test came in July 1996. A very quick search tells me.
Thank you. I gave you the time, Ben, and you rose to the challenge.
That replaced questions that were previously asked about the highway code during the practical test. Now, experts say the theory test is absolutely vital. And also because these days, most people down, there's various different apps from the AA and so on that you can test yourself using your phone. It's very simple. And actually, it's not so much the test that's really important. People revising, are by default taking in more information about how to behave on the roads. And actually, it was amazing. I was looking at a statistic earlier that you are asked 50 questions drawn from a bank of more than 700 during the theory test. You have to get 43 out of 50 right to pass the test. And they cover topics from road signs to traffic laws to vehicle safety, hazard awareness, first aid already, but now this will be upgraded to include life-saving techniques.
Thank you, Ben. I think that's really interesting. And Stephanie has just WhatsApped to say, first aid is part of your driving test in Germany. It is a 3-hour session that you need to complete before taking the test. That's incredibly impressive. Very sensible of the Germans to have done that. I'm one of those people who passed her test first time, although I probably shouldn't have done. That's all I'll say about that. I'm a relatively competent and safe driver now, I should say. But sometimes people do pass and it's a surprise. Shall we say it was? Certainly to my instructor. Now, what should the police be doing about catcallers? One police force decided to take to the streets to try and understand and expose the frequency with which women are harassed while they're exercising in public. Inspector John Vale is the Violence Against Women and Girls Safer Spaces lead for the police in Surrey, and he launched the pilot scheme. Inspector Vale, good afternoon. Just to explain how it works then.
Hey, good afternoon, Jane. Essentially, Surrey Police has launched a force-wide campaign now to stamp out street-based harassment against female runners. And that's part of our ongoing commitment to tackle public space violence against women and girls. And our campaign Jog On has seen new tactics being trialled, and they are designed to tackle harassment against female runners. They've actually come from an existing tactic that we have been regularly using over the last couple of years to tackle violence against women and girls within the nighttime economy, for example, using those plainclothes officers with additional training in behaviour detection. So looking out for predatory behaviours and intervening early.
Right, OK. I mean, I just want to hear about what it was like for the female officers involved. They went out in completely bog-standard running gear, if I can put it that way. Was it at night or during the day? What?
Yes, we've been running them at different times of the day, only in daylight hours at the moment. But of course, if we get information that suggests that actually we've got a particular problem at a time of night, then that's something that we can look at as well. So the pilot scheme that we have been running has been successful, which is why we're now expanding that across the rest of the county. We've had a number of positive interventions. So, for example, on our last operation at the end of July, we had two plainclothes officers, female officers. They were targeted within minutes. Firstly, by a male who beeped his horn at them, making gestures out of the window. And then a couple of minutes later, the exact same thing happened, but with another driver. So, you know, someone slowing down, staring, shouting, it's not always a criminal offence, but it can really have a huge impact on people's everyday lives and really stops women from doing everything that they should be able to do, such as something simple as going for a run.
Of course. I mean, I'm playing devil's advocate, though, Inspector. There will be people who just think, oh, you know, come on, get with it. At worst, this is puerile. You know, it's not really intimidating. They're just idiots. Just get on with your jog.
Yeah, and I have to say I completely disagree with that point of view. Clearly, as a force, our priority is not only to tackle and solve crime, but particularly when it comes to violence against women and girls, but also prevent it from happening in the first place. Now, as I said, you know, often we may not reach that criminal threshold. However, you know, the individuals that we're stopping, we're wanting to prevent that escalation of crime. So, you know, are they sexual offenders? Are they domestic abusers? The vast majority of cases, they're not. They just need some education at the side of the road. However, we have had cases where actually we need to go that bit further. We need to take additional measures to mitigate the risk moving forward.
When you say education at the side of the road, what does that consist of?
Well, realistically, it is around providing that the sort of evidence of the impact of the behaviours that they're exhibiting towards those female runners, you know, highlighting the fact that actually women sometimes don't go for a run because of these behaviours. They don't go to certain locations and, you know, they don't feel safe whilst they're out doing so. So that is really what we're trying to get across.
Yeah.
And obviously, if we can intervene at that early point, then we can prevent any escalation, as I say.
So to be clear, arrests have been made. Any charges?
So in terms of the specific Jog On campaign, we haven't made any arrests. We have done, as I say, a number of interventions. So in relation to our wider July Violence Against Women and Girls period of action, we made 18 arrests, and that was around the use of our behaviour detection officers. So they're essentially plainclothes officers within pubs, clubs, public spaces such as transport hubs, and identifying those predatory behaviours. But okay, specifically in relation to the Jog On campaign, no, there's no arrest, but plenty of interventions.
Right, OK. I mean, we're talking about free speech a little bit later in the programme this afternoon, and when you use terms like behaviour detection experts, I can see and hear people listening thinking, well, this is typical. This is Big Brother. You can't say anything anymore. You can't go anywhere anymore. Women are, I don't know, getting away with all sorts, and fellas just can't say a word. What is your retort to all that?
Well, what we're talking about here is women and girls being targeted purely because they are women and girls. And I think when you're in a situation where people are being targeted criminally purely because of their gender, then that is something that is completely unacceptable and needs to be addressed. And that, you know, when we're out in these operations, yes, our focus is violence against women and girls, but we are targeting a whole range of criminality. And of those 18 arrests that we made, as I mentioned before, you know, a number of those were for theft, for going equipped to commit theft, assaults, various other things as well. So we are having a, you know, that broad open mind and that approach to the campaign, and not being so, you know, tunnel visioned with it.
Mm. What sort of man does yell something or gesticulate to a woman who's jogging?
I'm not entirely sure that I'll be qualified to make much of a comment around that, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, are they troubled? Are they vulnerable? Are they just idiots?
Again, I wouldn't call anyone an idiot. However, clearly they need. Well, yes. Clearly, they do need to have you know, the behaviours that they're exhibiting challenged, and that is enough on certain occasions. On other occasions, as I mentioned before, you know, we are coming across individuals who are sex offenders, who are domestic abusers, and those are the individuals that we can then do that targeted, ongoing intervention work. So all around that prevention piece, you know, we're not looking at targeting anyone's free speech or picking on people or trying to catch people out. This is about identifying that risk and preventing crime, which is at the core of the values of British policing.
Yeah. And women, I mean, you're absolutely right. Of course, I agree with you that women should be as free to go jogging at any time of day or night, as free as any man. I mean, it shouldn't be in any way different, should it?
Absolutely not. And, you know, my message really is firstly to perpetrators or potential perpetrators. You know, we are regularly carrying out this campaign within the Surrey area, and no doubt it will be wider as well in the not too distant future. You know, bear in mind that the person that you're catcalling, the person that you're harassing, may end up being a female police officer, and there'll be a uniformed officer down the road waiting to pull that car over. My message to female runners, you know, and women and girls more generally, if there are locations, you know, within public areas where you feel unsafe, where things have happened, incidents have happened, then please do report them to us. You can also go on to the Street Safe website, it's a Home Office run website, where you can highlight anonymously locations where you feel unsafe and the reasons why. And those that data feeds straight into to neighbourhood teams, and we can then look to put measures in place to address it.
Thank you. Inspector John Vale, who is the Violence Against Women and Girls Safer Spaces lead for the police in Surrey. You can imagine the responses to this, but Holly says, police chasing catcallers, complete waste of time. They should get back to solving burglaries. Yeah, I mean, I think if you've ever attempted exercise as a woman in leisure gear, shall we say, you can attract all sorts of attention. Very little of it is in any way desirable, and it's profoundly annoying and frightening, actually, for a lot of women of all ages. If you're going on some long car journeys this summer, why not take us with you in your car? If you've got a DAB radio in the car, you just need to search the dial for Times Radio. And if you can't find it, you just need to rescan the radio. It doesn't take long, and it says here it usually works. If you do need more instructions, you can find them on the Times Radio website. Next, I'm going to be talking to a former science advisor to Barack Obama, as the current president, well, has his wicked way, it would be fair to say, with environmental policies. That's a bit later. Let's get the headlines. Here's Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. European allies are holding an hour of talks before putting their case to the United States. Britain says it's too prepared to act alone if no consensus on help for Ukraine is reached. EU leaders are seeking to reach a joint position, then press their case to Trump when he joins the call ahead of his meeting with Vladimir Putin later this week. Dr. Stefan Meister from the German Council on Foreign Relations isn't sure much will be achieved.
I'm rather sceptical if this really will have a huge impact on Donald Trump and his discussion with President Putin. We will see how it goes. I think for Putin, it's a big success to have this meeting.
Court of Appeal judges have been hearing arguments on both sides concerning the sentence of a boy who killed elderly dog walker Bim Coley in a Leicestershire park. One team argues the seven-year term for manslaughter is not long enough, while his or lawyers want to reduce it. Three children have been charged with murdering a man on the Isle of Sheppey in Kent. A 12-year-old remains in custody. Police will be encouraged to tell the public the nationalities and ethnicities of suspects when they're charged in high-profile cases. The National Police Chiefs Council says it's to reduce the risk to public safety where there are high levels of misinformation. And the Foreign Secretary has referred himself to the Environment Watchdog after he took the US Vice President fishing in Kent without the proper licences. Another thing David Lammy didn't have was fish, as he failed to catch any. Remember, our news podcasts are on the Times Radio app. Look for the Times News Briefing and the World in 10.
This is Times Radio.
Oh, bad traffic. Great news, isn't it? More time in the car. Joy. Maybe you don't feel it. Maybe you don't drive a Lexus NX yet. But when you do, you'll see the positive of peak hour, the delight in a detour, the love of the long way. The Lexus NX plug-in hybrid. Experience amazing before you arrive.
Play the opening game of Final One Standing by William Hill for your chance to win a share of £500,000 jackpot. It's free to play. Simply join the opening league before 12:30 on Saturday, 16th of August, and pick a team to win in the opening round. Then pick a team to win each week. You can only pick each team once, and if you're the final one standing, then the jackpot is yours. Final One Standing by William Hill. Football's ultimate elimination game. 18 plus online. Runs from 28th of July 2025. Price split if all players lose in the same round. Paid in 48 hours. T's and C's apply. Play responsibly.
Yes, that price includes full technical support.
Oh dear, the buy now button on each page isn't clickable.
Layla's web development agency will soon have more clients than they can handle. To avoid a code red, she needs new programmers.
Okay, I've just tweaked the code, so everything should be fine now.
Indeed can help her find great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. Because Indeed's hiring platform makes finding great talent easy. To start hiring, visit Indeed.com/try today.
This is Times Radio.
This from Jamie, who says, oh, we're reporting based on feelings now. Either a crime is committed or it's not. Men shouldn't be acting this way. But then again, all sorts of people shouldn't act in certain ways, but they do. I don't like it much when people are rude. Should we have a hotline to report people for being mean as well? Yes, we should. Thank you for that, Jamie. I will be personing that hotline and dealing with all the complaints. Callum MacDonald is here to tell you what he's got in his programme between 4 o'clock and seven.
Hello.
Hello.
It's going to be one of those days. We are, like you, awaiting news of the phone calls that are happening, the virtual summits that are happening this afternoon. First of all, between European leaders and then obviously one involving President Trump as well. I'm quite intrigued as to what the European leaders are hoping for today. What would be a good outcome? And there's some reporting around that they are kind of considering whether they should even attempt to try to get a promise from President Trump that he will not commit to land swaps between Russia and Ukraine, which is such a sticking point, obviously, for President Zelensky of Ukraine particularly. So can the Europeans have any sway on that particular aspect of this Alaska summit that's coming up on Friday? Apparently the other thing the European leaders will tell President Trump today is not to trust any ceasefire promises from Putin, which in some ways you would hope would go without saying, based on history and precedent, yeah. But it's one of those things that perhaps needs saying anyway. And then obviously the kind of the role of the Chancellor of Germany, Chancellor Merz, so he'll be holding a press conference while we're on air, so we'll probably bring you some of that live, but we'll certainly bring you the headlines in any case. And the overarching thought, I think, as we build up towards this Alaska summit, as we've been doing for several days, is that if President Zelensky rejects any deal regardless of how one-sided it is, in Trump's mind, will that make Zelensky the enemy again, as it would seem he had been a few months ago? And Ukraine is then seen by Trump as the primary obstacle to peace, and that would be a huge triumph for Putin. So we're considering all of these things in the programme today. We've got a whole range of people joining us, former advisors to the Ukrainian president, insiders, or former insiders of President Trump's administration, as well as our own correspondents from The Times. Catherine Philp, who you had on a while ago, Jane, will be back with us to try and just keep us across the details as they're flowing in, because we should get some updates through the course of the afternoon and evening.
Well, I did enjoy Catherine reminiscing about that summit she was at
in Helsinki. Yes.
When Fiona Hill was tempted to fake a seizure. I mean, it's, seizures are not in any way funny.
No, of course, but it's astonishing.
Things went so badly, she thought it might be an option. Okay, well, a busy couple of hours in the company of Callum McDonald here on Times Radio between 4 o'clock and seven. Now, we know that Donald Trump is currently having that conversation with European leaders, but the US president is also trying to secure, it would seem, another sort of legacy, slashing the rules protecting the environment, ending the monitoring of greenhouse gases, and also ending climate commitments. Now, his Environmental Protection Agency kicked off the year with what it called the biggest deregulatory action in US history. But what does that mean, and what impact will this all have on our planet? Let's talk now to a former Obama science advisor, Dr. John Holdren. He is now a research professor at Harvard University. Dr. Holdren, good afternoon from us in the UK. First of all, if you were asked to sum up the Trump regime, the Trump administration's attitude to the environment, how would you describe it?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. I think the quick description is that Trump and his acolytes don't know anything about environmental damage, about climate change, about toxic substances, about the harm to well-being that all those phenomena are causing. Secondly, they're proud of not knowing anything. And third, they don't want anyone else to know anything. So they have been systematically dismantling the government's support for research on environmental problems of all kinds, above all climate change and toxic substances. They have been dismantling government's capacity not just to understand but to regulate these problems. The latest instance of that, the one that the EPA administrator has described as the greatest deregulatory action in U.S. history, is an attempt to discard, to throw overboard the endangerment finding of 2009, which is the finding supported by the U.S. Supreme Court at the time that gives the Environmental Protection Agency the power to regulate heat-trapping emissions, greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles and industry. This would be a catastrophic progress that has occurred largely up until now, and it would have immense adverse impacts ultimately on public health, on the U.S. economy, and on the world, because greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, of course, don't care where they came from.
No.
More coming from the United States will harm everybody.
How is it possible that the Trump administration can do this? Are there not laws restricting them?
There are laws restricting them, and in the end, one has to rely on some combination of the courts, the Congress, and the voters to rein Trump in on these matters. He has unfortunately already demonstrated a willingness to either circumvent or ignore court orders. He and his acolytes have been extremely ingenious in playing the court system in ways that delay any final conclusion almost indefinitely and allow the Trump administration to continue its perverse intrusions into the country's environmental research and regulation while the court proceedings drag on. Counting on the voters, of course, is a long-term issue. Mm. Many people in the United States say, well, we just have to wait for the 2026 midterm elections, and then perhaps we can reverse the dominance of Republicans in both the House of Representatives and the Senate and then expect the Congress to rein Trump in. My view is that we can't afford to wait till 2026. The damage being done in the meantime is too great for us to have the luxury of waiting for those elections. And what we really need is for about half a dozen Republican senators and half a dozen Republican members of the House of Representatives to grow a spine in the meantime, to decide that their loyalty to the Constitution of the United States and to the interests of their constituents should outweigh their fear of Trump.
It's quite bizarre to me. I'm sure you have seen this, that earlier this week, the Energy Department posted on X a post about coal, identifying coal, by the way, as female, which is in itself quite bizarre, and saying she's an icon, she's a legend, and she is the moment. And this is alongside a lump of coal. Can you explain that?
It's very hard to explain some of the actions that emanate from the Trump administration on these matters. What coal really is the dirtiest form of energy that we have and that we have used historically in very large quantities to immense consequences in the environment and for public health. The goal of our energy policy should be to reduce our dependence on coal as rapidly as possible, both in this country and around the world. The United States was on a trajectory to doing exactly that, and the Trump administration is now trying to revive the properly faltering coal industry. I'm not quite sure what the strategy is in terms of calling coal a female, but it's simply another preposterous misrepresentation of reality by the Trump administration in the attempt to advance what is really a very destructive agenda.
Really interesting to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Former Obama science advisor, Dr. John Holdren. He is now a research professor at Harvard. Now, the country's longest-running literary festival is back. There are more than 400 events. It is the Times and Sunday Times Cheltenham Literature Festival, also sponsored by Times Radio. And today it's unveiled some big, big stars from the worlds of books, screen and politics who have signed up to appear this year. Nicola Tuxworth is the head of programming at Cheltenham. She's been telling me who she is most excited about.
I think on the literary side, I'm very pleased about Chimamanda coming because that's Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, who's receiving the Sunday Times Prize for Literary Excellence. She doesn't do much live stuff and hasn't been here for a while. So I think that's going to be a very exciting interview. And her new book is wonderful, Dream Count. So I'm excited about that. I'm excited about Ben Elton in conversation with Richard Curtis. I think that'll be a warm, funny, reflective conversation between two long-time collaborators. I'm excited about the new voices we've got on the programme. We've got a real track record now in breaking new fiction and new writing. So I think we've figured out how to do that. So that'll be, you know, people like Nisobe Yunus and with Fundamentally, you know, some of those real standout debuts of this year. And The Big Read is back after a 10-year hiatus. So I could go on and on, as you can tell.
No, but it's brilliant. And I absolutely hear the enthusiasm. Let's talk about The Big Read, because it went away for a decade. What is it and which book is involved this year?
Right. So in the past, so we had a sort of 10-year hiatus. And in the past, the idea was to bring the festival audience together around a particular book, and we would choose one every year, and it might have been around a big anniversary. Like one year we did the first ever Bond novel, because I don't know if you know, but the Ian Fleming novels are a lot darker than the films and a bit more interesting, really.
Right.
Anyway, but I decided to sort of park it for a while for various reasons, and this year we thought we would bring it back, but around a debut novelist. And the novelist we've chosen this year is Kalyanne Bradbury, who's wonderful. The Mystery of Time is just the most terrific read with all sorts of interesting themes in it. And so we're going to be posting off copies of that into unexpected addresses, and people are going to be able to find copies of it round the site and in Gloucestershire. And then we're bringing Kalyan and readers together at the festival to to enjoy talking about it.
I have read that, actually. If anyone had been able had told me earlier that I was going to be riveted by the story of a woman who falls for a long dead polar explorer, I would have said not on your Nelly. But it absolutely grabs you, and it's a great.
It does, and you sort of fall in love with him too.
Actually. No, he's a lovely chap. I mean, he's got some very old-fashioned attitudes, but then I suppose that's inevitable. Yeah, it's a great book. Kalyan Bradley's The Ministry of Time. So you can actually, if you have already read it, or you can get hold of a copy, you can take part in the big read at Cheltenham. I should say that Fi and I are going to be live at the festival. We are talking to Penny Lancaster, who has many admirers from her televisual appearances and from her work as a special constable. What other celebrities have you got there?
Celebrities, we've got a couple of Gavin and Stacey's. We've got Joanna Page, who's written her memoir Lush, and Larry Lamb, who's being he's written a novel and he's being interviewed by his son, which will be lovely. They're lovely together. Joanna Lumley is here. So yeah, there's a wide range of sort of stars of stage and screen. Oti Mabuse is also here. So, you know, I think festivals should be fun, and so I think it's nice to be able to go to something in the evening that's you know, a bit lighter and a bit more enjoyable.
Yes, why ever not? Why not enjoy yourself? I mean, we're lucky in this country to be able to enjoy ourselves, although according to the US State Department, perhaps not for much longer, because they keep telling us that Britain is going backwards and that we are maybe on the cusp of losing our freedom of speech. But I gather at Cheltenham there are quite a few, well, challenging talks. You don't always have to hear stuff you like, do you?
No, and so my sort of objective around, you know, events that where people have quite entrenched positions, or that where there's a very sort of traumatic situation going on, for example, obviously in Gaza, is how can we have a conversation on our stages that will give people a bit more food for thought and a bit of an inkling about other people's perspectives. And, you know, like for me, if someone comes out of our audience and says, do you know, I never thought of that. I never thought of it like that. That's a win for me. And I always say to participants that we're inviting for debates and things, you know, we're not going to have a furious questions time style row on stage. That's just not what it's about.
No.
And we've got a long track record doing these discussions very successfully, and actually with the help of a lot of Times columnists and journalists. So I think people trust us to pick our way through this stuff and actually do something productive.
And how do people get tickets for any event at Cheltenham?
The public on sale is the 4th of September, but if you want to get ahead of the game, you could go to cheltenhamfestivals.org and join as a member, which means you'd support the charity and that you also get perks for all four of our festivals. And then you can grab your tickets on the 28th of August. So you can be sure to see Jane and Fi live.
You wouldn't want to miss out, would you? That's Nicola Tuxworth, Head of Programming at Cheltenham. We are there talking to our special guest, Penny Lancaster, at the Cheltenham Literature Festival on Thursday, October the 16th. It's Times Radio, and we're talking television with leading critic Scott Bryan. In a moment, it's 10 to 3.
Early breakfast on Times Radio with Elavon. As a new day dawns, Times Radio connects you with the latest breaking news and provides intelligent opinion on all the morning headlines. Plus, get ahead of all the markets with updates, analysis and insight with Times Radio's daily dedicated business bulletin. Early breakfast, every Monday to Friday morning from 5 on Times Radio with Elavon. Your world of payments. Find out more at elavon.co.uk.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today and discover why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Learn more at viking.com.
How are you looking so fresh? It's my new Samsung Galaxy Watch 8. It's got this thing called Running Coach, which creates custom training plans just for me. Oh, and that's our cue to pick up the pace.
What? This isn't fast enough. No. Oh.
Smash your fitness goals with a new Galaxy Watch 8. Buy today at Samsung.com. Requires smartphone on Android 11 or above with the latest version of the Samsung Health app.
This is Times Radio.
Shall we have the Strictly theme tune? I'm not sure whether we can fire it up or not. It is traditional to start any conversation that may involve that popular television show with the theme tune. I think we've got it. Yes. It's Strictly Come Dancing lineup announcement time. Scott Bryan is our favourite TV critic, and he's with me now. Hello, Scott.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine, thank you. I enjoy this time of year when the lineup is announced and everybody complains about it and says they haven't heard of anybody. Is it the same as ever?
I mean, I think so. I mean, I think it's actually one of the best cast shows on TV because you're having to do something that is quite tricky, which is having to get people from pretty much every demographic. So someone from the kids TV show world, you've got Nitro from Gladiators, also having somebody that maybe might be on a soap, you know, appeasing the parents perhaps, or someone's gran or nan. And then also having kind of somebody who might kind of get social media involved as well. My favourite reaction, because there's been press statements released over the course of last week by the BBC, pretty much dropping around the clock. It's been quite a machine. My favourite has been from Alex Kingston, who's been, of course, in many different things, but most recently on Doctor Who. Mm. Her press statement, where you normally have a quote from somebody saying how excited they are to be in the show. For Alex, it's just the words, and eight exclamation marks, right, and nothing else.
Okay. Well done. I think that's probably how I'd have reacted, if I'm honest. the people I've heard of, I don't want to be too dismissive. I've certainly heard of her. Heard of Danny Dyer. That's the younger Danny Dyer, not Danny Dyer, the dad. Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank, the footballer. And Chris Robshaw, a rugby player. So you're right, that there is sort of something for everybody. And yes, I imagine that as ever, it will get people talking. But is it quite the show it once was? There is quite a lot of negativity around Strictly these days, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the show has certainly been through the ringer in the last couple of years. And I think, obviously, stories about what may or may not be happening behind the scenes have been ways to sell papers, and they have been for the time being. And I think the show has had to sort of make some adjustments, I think, in regards to not only in relation to the dancers who participate in the programme, but also the celebrity welfare too. I think ratings-wise, I mean, this is the weird thing. I always find that Strictly operates in a parallel universe, in the fact that there can be a lot of reporting and talking around the show, but actually when you tune into the show, everything is as normal as it's always been.
Exactly.
I mean, it's never making any relation to what might be reported on it. But the ratings are holding up well. It slips every year, but to get anything over, particularly for a final, anything over 8 million, you know, in this sort of time and place in terms of all streaming is a miracle. And this is the only show that manages to do it.
Yep, and it's got to be acknowledged. Talking of ratings, Match of the Day, the new presenting lineup is Kelly Cates, Gabby Logan and Mark Chapman. Will people be looking at whether the ratings drop? Or actually, I mean, my theory was always that people watch for the goals. They don't actually care that much who's presenting it. But what do you think?
I mean, I think it's interesting how, since Gary Lineker's departure, I think the BBC have been seeing this to really make a big kind of attempt to refresh and modernise the whole programme. And there's been a lot of emphasis equally on the fact that they've got more digital rights in terms of showing sport action, those goals, you know, maybe earlier in the day, as well as sort of trying to make the show kind of less linear in terms of it, basically much more of a digital offering. Mm. I think also, though, there will be a lot of scrutiny on the programme, just trying to make sure that it actually, you know, retains at least the feel that has made the show so popular. They're making tweaks as well as a matcher for day two. It will just be called matcher for day from now on. So it will be uniform. And of course, having a presenting lineup that will change and be consistent, you know, throughout, rather than being consistent throughout each week. I think obviously the way that the press will get a hold of this is that if the ratings are not strong as last year, they'll say, oh, it's been a big disaster. You know, this refresh hasn't worked. Mm. I mean, I guess it comes down to how confident the BBC feels that this new format change is actually what audiences want.
Okay. Oh, well, it'd be interesting to see what happens. But I have to say, all three of the new presenters are really good sports presenters. I mean, I don't think anyone could possibly disagree with their competence. Let's talk about Alien Earth, which has landed on Disney Plus. Now, is this good?
It is. I mean, I think if you've been sort of scrolling through TV thinking, my word, when is it actually going to get better? This is the first show that I would say in nearly a month, bar the sport, that I've been actually excited by.
Right.
Normally, prequels and sequels of TV shows are something that kind of, it never really lands because it's treading on the coattails of what makes a show so great, but it also might be kind of a bit inaccessible to casual fans. You have to have a whole encyclopedic knowledge about what happens in this world to know what's happening. I mean, that's the same case I get with the Amazon Lord of the Rings series. It's completely difficult for me to connect with. But with Alien Earth, it manages to retain, I think, all of the things that made the iconic Ridley Scott film popular, whilst also being a completely different, unique sci-fi story that basically you don't need that much knowledge about beforehand. And I think the cinematography, the look of it, is absolutely stunning. It's something I think normally sci-fi to me can end up feeling quite cold or distant or irrelevant. Mm. This is set in the near future, but feels strikingly relevant and a bit like Black Mirror throughout in its kind of dystopian vibes. I think it's certainly one to look out for.
Okay, that sounds interesting. I have been absorbed, I have to say, in one of those weird former ITV murder mysteries that's now a hit on Netflix. I think it was originally called The Lock, but now it's called Loch Ness. Maybe I'm wrong about the name change. I don't know. Why does this keep happening? That, you know, not particularly new offerings from ITV end up storming up the Netflix charts?
I mean, I think part of it is the fact that Netflix have got an algorithm that means that they can push out shows sort of to a big selection of audiences if it starts to pick up with a certain smaller set of an audience. Like they have so much reach and of course millions of people around the world, that if a show starts to perform well once it's been added to their platform, then they just show it to a lot more people straight right. away. That's where you get really kind of jarred by all those awful trailers yelling at you.
Yeah.
I think I'd be interested what Kevin Ligo, who's the head of ITV, thinks of this, because it must be a bit frustrating to think that you've got a whole new drama slate and yet a show that everyone's talking about was from 7 years ago on a different platform.
Very briefly, I mean, ITV, do they get money from? They must get money from this if Netflix buy it, presumably.
Yes, I mean, I think they certainly do, so I wouldn't be able to know how much, but I guess less than, you know, people going directly to ITV and watching it through their own broadcaster.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether it's good or not. It isn't particularly, but the scenery is lovely. The scenery is lovely, and I genuinely don't know who's done it. Whoever they are,
wow.
They need catching, Scott, I'll tell you that much. Scott Bryan, thank you very much. That is the Netflix show I've been watching called Loch Ness, currently available.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
3 o'clock now. Good afternoon. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio until four. And coming up in that next hour, does Britain really have a problem with free speech, as the Trump administration claims? Let us know what you think about that. How to save the environment, one deleted email at a time. And if you've got a view on Nicola Sturgeon, maybe it will be changed when you hear my interview with her after 3:30. She is, of course, the former First Minister of Scotland. She's written a very big memoir, a very long memoir, lots of words in it. It's called Frankly. Let's start with the news from Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Within the last few minutes, judges have decided the prison sentence won't change for a teenager found guilty of killing elderly dog walker Bim Coley in a park in Leicestershire. The 80-year-old was punched, kicked and racially abused in Braunston Town last September. Judges dismissed a referral from the Attorney General, who'd argued the 7-year term for manslaughter wasn't long enough. The 15-year-old boy's team wanted it to come down, his Lady Justice Macur rejecting that.
The sentence was a very significant sentence. And necessarily so. It was entirely warranted by and commensurate with the seriousness of the offence. It is simply unarguable that the sentence was manifestly excessive or wrong in principle.
European allies have been holding an hour of talks before putting their case to the United States. Britain says it's prepared to act alone if no consensus on help for Ukraine is reached. EU leaders are seeking to reach a joint position, then press their case to Donald Trump when he joins a call ahead of the meeting with Vladimir Putin later this week. The Times World Affairs editor Catherine Phillips says their message will be clear.
That they need to be part of this process, that Ukraine cannot be forced into making any concessions without its consent, and that really these negotiations between Russia and America cannot take place over the head of the continent for whom they have the most resonance and risk.
The police's use of facial recognition technology is to be significantly expanded in an attempt to catch more criminals. 10 U police vans, which can scan faces and check against a list of wanted suspects, will be rolled out in 7 police forces in England. They've already been used in and around London and South Wales. Dr. Luke Roberts from the Centre of Science and Policy at Cambridge University says there needs to be proper scrutiny.
AI is not foolproof. It does hallucinate. It does make things up from time to time as well. So this kind of depends on just these two things, the technology companies and the police, without some form of ethical and public scrutiny becomes really important.
Nicola Sturgeon has told Times Radio there's a worrying double standard applied to male and female politicians, as she recounted what she's described as the ousting of Theresa May by Boris Johnson.
If she or any female politician turned up looking like he does, or as unprepared as he is, no woman in politics would last 5 minutes. And yet we normalise it with men. And I think over the last couple of years, we are normalising it more and more and more, that is becoming the model of a successful politician. And I think that is deeply concerning.
The former SNP First Minister has been speaking ahead of the publication of her autobiography. You can hear the full interview in around half an hour's time with Jane and Fee in the Off Air podcast. Off Air with Jane and Fee podcast. Remember, our news podcasts are on the Times Radio app too. Look for the Times News Briefing and the World in 10.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Good afternoon. So here's the lineup from now until 4 p.m. this afternoon here on Times Radio. We have the full unexpurgated conversation with former Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon coming your way just after 3:30. We're going to talk tech with Chris Stokel-Walker. First, though, we are going to talk about free speech and whether or not Britain has a free speech problem. Apparently it does. At least that's the consensus of the Trump administration, who have accused the UK government of repeatedly imposing serious restrictions on human rights in the last year. Baroness Fox, Claire Fox, is the director of the Academy of Ideas, and she's able to join me now. Hello, Claire. How are you?
Good to be with you, Jane.
Very nice to have you on the programme. So, first of all, how do we deal with the fact that so many people listening will think this current US administration has got a right cheek having a go at Britain and restrictions on human rights and free speech? What do you say to that?
Well, I do think that there's a degree of double standards here, and I could list the number of ways that I'm concerned about what the American administration is doing for free speech, not least in relation to campuses and so on. But that would just be a kind of whataboutery point. And I think it's more important for us to own this problem, because I think we've genuinely got a huge challenge ahead of us. Those of us who are concerned about free speech in general being eroded in a more censorious climate.
Right. I want to get from you, if you don't mind, sorry to interrupt, but some practical examples. You say we need to own our problem. What are the issues we need to own? What would you identify?
Well, the unintended consequences of the Online Safety Act are now being felt very widely, with perfectly legal, although accused of being harmful, material being removed. This was brought in very much with the headlines that it was about protecting children. But in fact, the vast majority of the legislation, I'd say about 80% of it, because I was involved in it in the Lords, actually will undermine and impact on adult freedom to express opinions. And we've seen removed from the online world everything from discussions on the online grooming gangs and the rape gangs to discussions on the asylum hotels and so on. So perfectly legitimate political discourse taken away.
So, sorry, today, I'm not aware of that. Sorry. I mean, I would not be free to express a perfectly reasonable point of view about grooming gangs anymore because of the Online Safety Act.
No, but of course you would, but you wouldn't necessarily guarantee that it would stay on the level of social media, and it could be removed and has been removed. The speech by Katie Lamb, the MP, Conservative MP, about the grooming gangs, for example, which was pretty graphic, was removed from social media platforms on the basis that children might come across it. So that's an example, and a wide range of people across the political spectrum are making this point. I mean, everybody from the person who runs Wikipedia, who's very definitely on the liberal left on this, is saying it's a disaster for freedom of expression, this act, and right the way through to ordinary people, free speech and human rights organisations. And it was mentioned indeed by these legislators who came over to the UK and investigated these things. But even today, I mean, I know that I'm looking forward to listening to your interview with Nicola Sturgeon, but even today, her book is called Frankly. Well, frankly, what's been happening in Scotland in relation to free speech is quite astonishing. And only today we've heard in the Times newspaper, in fact, that the National Library of Scotland have refused to have a book about sex and gender because it was objected to as offensive. So you've got this kind of informal removal of material that's offensive. The Women Who Wouldn't Wish has won so many awards, was nominated by everyone to go in the library, and it's been taken out because some people say it's offensive. So we know that kind of informal censorship is happening the whole time. And even The Economist, again, not a radical magazine at any stretch, has noted that the UK, along with Germany, is one of the most censorious climates at the moment, stating that 30 people a day are being arrested for speech offences. So that's an awfully big moment for us to take into consideration whether we really are free to speak.
I think you're absolutely right. No one has the right not to be offended. Listen, I mean, I'm livid and quite offended. I don't know, 80% of the time, it seems, at the moment, really. But I still manage to trundle on. I think it's the fact that, to many people, it's the audacity of the likes of J.D. Vance lecturing us in Britain about free speech and about freedom when parts of the United States do not allow any access to abortion. That just...
Yeah, but that's a practical... Well, no, I'm appalled by that. I'm absolutely, and I would argue against it. Of course I would. And, but it's just that I can get affronted by J.D. Vance stating, dropping some truth bombs, as it were, because it's him that's doing it. But I'm actually more upset and affronted by the fact the truth bombs are true. And, we have our own politicians. I'm one of them, that have to deal with what it means to be in a free society, in a democratic society, and to be constantly having to fight off attempts at shaping the narrative, as that's the government's terms, so that we do not allow issues that they find difficult to enter into the public sphere. That is a very dangerous situation. And you as a journalist will know that we've only recently heard about the super, super injunctions that were used to curtail any discussion on the leak of the Afghan refugees coming into this country.
Yeah.
And although we can say, initially it was about protecting people, it was carried on for 2 years and even Parliament wasn't allowed to discuss it. That is a very serious erosion of our civil liberties and of our human rights and all of the rest of it, which, if Donald Trump did it, we would be lecturing him, right? J.D. Vance was involved in a cover-up like that, we would be abhorred and we would say so, and we would be right to, whereas somehow we are not allowed to mention this about domestic problems that we're facing.
When people say you can't say anything these days, when did these days start?
Well, of course, there's hyperbole here, and I don't want to be in a situation where I say that you can't say anything. But if you're also walking on eggshells constantly, then I think there is a problem. I think that when you ask when it started, I think the emergence of identity politics in the last two decades has crept into a situation in which different victim groups will say, you can't say that. I find that offensive. You know, I wrote a book in 2016, I think, called I Find That Offensive, republished in 2018. I still can't find that. I still find that offensive, which is the way that that terminology started to be used. And what we're told is not that things are illegal and therefore they should be censored, but that they are causing people psychological harm. And what we've done is we've managed to conflate words with actions, because you use the example of the abortion issue in America. Again, I'm outraged as well at any attempt to attacking reproductive rights of women anywhere in the world, including in the UK. But I would also be appalled if we were not allowed to discuss such issues. And there is a difference between a debate and a discussion about abortion, for example, and the removal of the facilities of abortion. If we can't tell the difference, we won't know what battles to fight. And so it seems to me hugely important that we retain that distinction and we don't say that physical harm, genuine things that will actually cause physical problems for people, are the same as words which people say are hurtful.
Can we just talk about a practical example? I mean, changing tack slightly, but what do you think J.D. Vance would have thought about those arrests at Westminster over the weekend of the people protesting peacefully in support of the outlawed, the proscribed organisation, Palestine Action?
I hope that he would have been consistent, as I try and be, and say that that was one of the most dangerous attacks on free speech that we've seen. Now, this is a difficult situation. I consider Palestine Action to be an abhorrent organisation, and they have indulged in actions which actually constitute up close to terrorism, certainly criminal, totally irresponsible, and their attitude to Israel, and in fact, the whole question of their kind of Israelophobia, in my view, goes into anti-Semitism. However, I think that it was completely wrong for the government to prescribe them as a terrorist organisation, as much as anything, because that prescription has now meant that anyone who expresses support for them will be, as we saw, arrested. And that is an attack on free speech. So I've no idea whether J.D. Vance would think that was a good or a bad thing.
I put it to you that I appreciate you are consistent. I suspect he probably isn't consistent.
Well, and that's one of the problems in America at the moment with American campuses. We have seen that people have been dragooned and, you know, threatened with deportation for their pro-Palestinian point of view, which is a terrible indictment of any, and you know, could be you could accuse them of double standards. And indeed, at the moment, the leading free speech organisation in America, FIRE, are actually suing the government for just that, the breach of First Amendment rights. But let's be clear, America has got a First Amendment, and we can hold it to account for not living up to that First Amendment. We have got nowhere near a First Amendment. And in fact, free speech in America, in theory, is a much higher standard than it is in the UK, where it's basically, I believe in free speech, but. And this, by the way, is not just the Labour government, but the Conservative government before it as well.
Can I just have a quick word from you on the story that The Times is reporting this afternoon, that Kemi Badenoch has nominated the former Olympic silver medalist, wasn't she? She should have got the gold, Sharon Davis, as a Conservative peer. And now Sharon Davis has long been a gender critical campaigner, and she's praised Kemi Badenoch as one of the first ministers to push back against woke. So is this a good appointment, potentially?
Oh, God, it's so exciting. I mean, I wish she wasn't a Conservative peer, and I wish that she would be nominated as a non-affiliated as I am. But I don't care what the label is. I am absolutely adore Sharon Davis because she's been brave and courageous, and she got so much stick for actually arguing for women's sports. I mean, can you imagine a situation where a female Olympian was treated as though she was far right? And this is another censorious aspect of this debate, where you're basically demonized and attacked for expressing biological reality. and to defending women's sports and women's safe sports and competitiveness and fairness. And she was treated as though she was a pariah. She deserves an accolade. Being given a seat in the House of Lords is not necessarily the accolade that everyone would want. But regardless, I'm glad that she's being recognised in a positive way.
Thank you for your time, Claire. That's Claire Fox, Baroness Fox, the director of the Academy of Ideas. Now, news just coming in about those talks that were going on. They are ones between the US President Donald Trump and the European leaders on Ukraine. They have finished, apparently. France's Emmanuel Macron is speaking in Berlin. He told reporters that President Trump said that any territorial issues can only be negotiated with Ukraine. And Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky and Germany's Friedrich Merz are currently holding a news conference. We'll bring you more on that as we have it, as we say here in broadcasting. I can hardly bring it to you if I don't have it, in all fairness. So stay tuned. Obviously, those talks have wound up. And I can see on the TV screens in the studio that Chancellor Merz is talking at the moment, and Zelensky standing next to him. Can we just dip into that? Are we able to?
Wir haben uns heute zunächst ausführlich mit den Amtskolleginnen und Kollegen aus Frankreich, Großbritannien, Polen, Italien und Finnland sowie mit Ursula von der Leyen, Antonio Costa und Mark Rutte.
Some names being checked there. I'm afraid my O-level German is not quite up to telling you exactly what's going on, but I also heard Finland mentioned. I can certainly bring you that exclusive. We will tell you exactly what's been announced a little later. So it's that time of the week when we talk tech, and I can't believe it, he's actually here.
Everything's computer.
Not him, but Chris Stokel-Walker. Hello, Chris.
Hello. My German is not brilliant, Jane, either, so unfortunately I can't.
I was going to turn to you then, thinking you may be the answer, but no. Never mind. You are, though, the king of tech, and we can't. Really, it's brilliant to have you in London. Thank you.
No, not at all. I am sweating and not doing very well in this. Northern constitution does not hold it
very
well.
Listen, Geordies are just not meant to be in... is it 33 Celsius today?
I lost count, basically.
It's have you been on the underground, you poor man?
No, I walked. I walked from King's Cross all the way here because I thought that would be better than just, going through the hell that was the underground.
a fug of clamminess. Okay, that must have been absolutely gorgeous. Right. Now, this is something I've actually done, and I hope I've done the right thing. This is this idea that if you've got any old photos that are stored, and particularly the emails in your trash, you can really help the environment by deleting them. Now, this was something that came out yesterday. Is it true, first of all?
Unfortunately not, Jane. Oh. So you have done very well, right, but it's not really needed. I was speaking to experts on this yesterday in terms of the environmental impact of our digital lives, and actually they said that the reality of doing this will use up more bad things on tech than it would to actually just leave it alone. So it's well-meaning, but actually not necessarily that good for the environment in the long run.
What about the stuff in my spam? I mean, I just get some extraordinary stuff. I do look at my spam occasionally just to see what's there. I mean, the number of you-know-what extensions I'm offered as a 61-year-old woman, it's just quite extraordinary. I mean, why do they think I'd need one? Do I not delete those either?
No, you can just leave them be, because actually what you do when you access those is you end up calling them back from the data centres. And the Environment Agency here has said that this is the issue, which is why they want you to try and solve this. Data centres, we know, are obviously vitally important. They serve all of these things that we use day to day in our digital lives, but actually they require a lot of cooling, and that's water, that's electricity. That is a problem. If you leave them be, then you're not actually going to be calling that data center and using that water or that energy. So I'm not really sure where this came from. I've spoken to lots of these experts in the last day or so since this happened.
They're all denying it, aren't they?
Yeah, they're saying this is more damaging than it is to just leave it be and not do anything. One data point that might be useful, 17 grams of carbon dioxide emissions for every single email that we send. Now, last year, the UK had carbon emissions of 371 million tonnes. So really, what you're doing is not going to make a big dent in this impact.
Can I ask, when emails first came in, which, I mean, I'm thinking about it, the first time I got one, I remember, was the mid-1990s. That would be about right, wouldn't
it?
Yeah. Did anybody think about the environmental cost?
No, I think that was not really at the front of mind then, because it was so incredibly small. And what's happened is since then, we've had kind of piecemeal additions. So now, as you mentioned, we get emails about every which thing. We send WhatsApp messages, which are big problems as well. And we then go to Netflix, we go to YouTube, we go to TikTok, and all of these platforms do have their carbon dioxide emissions. So the experts that I spoke to this week were saying that actually, individually, this isn't a problem, but it's good that we're aware of it and that we ought to start lobbying the big tech companies to say, well, actually, you need to do something about it because you are foisting all of this on us, not least with AI as well, which is increasingly coming into our lives. And that does have an impact, but it is really higher up that this should be done on the chain rather than us.
And these data centres, these huge places, well, I say huge, I'm assuming they are. How I mean, does every local area have one?
Not necessarily, but there are lots in sort of what's called the Golden Triangle, which is kind of between the Midlands and London. So there's a section, I don't know my roads, but you know, around that area where basically you have lots of Amazon warehouses, which deliver you all of your goods around the country. And you also have lots of these data centres. Now, they need to be relatively close to you because of what we call latency. So when you type in a URL, a website address, and you hit enter, that then has to get sent to a data centre and kind of pull it out. So the further away, the longer you wait. But it's only milliseconds that we're talking about.
OK, thank you for that. I just find this a boggler, so you're going to have to take me very slowly through through this. Sam Altman, OpenAI, that's right, isn't it, has once again, he's thrown down the tech gauntlet to Elon Musk because he's preparing to back a company that is going to rival Neuralink, which is Musk's company, which wants to link the human brain and computers.
So lots of people who have had life-changing injuries, who are unable to perhaps move their arms or their legs or to do pretty much anything in life, how are now being able to actually do that through these brain implants. So essentially, you have a kind of very thin film that is implanted on your brain, cables come down from that, and it changes the power of thought into the muscle movement that you need to do this sort of stuff. And Elon Musk has actually made an awful lot of strides on this with Neuralink. It is worth pointing out that actually academic researchers have been doing this for quite a while. It's just that Musk, as we know, is a big showman, and so we are seeing this. There are currently trials going on in the UK for this sort of stuff, actually signing up people in the last month or so.
And we should be very wary about being negative about something that could transform lives.
Yeah, and this is life-changing, and we have already seen evidence of this. You know, admittedly, it is kind of anecdotal, one or two examples of this, but people are saying that their lives are being transformed by Neuralink implants right now, mostly in the US. But Sam Altman wants in on this. He's said that he thought that this should have happened by 2025, several years ago. We are, of course, now in 2025. So there is a company that is seeking funding and is looking like it's going to get hundreds of millions of dollars, probably about a quarter of a billion from OpenAI, which is, of course, Sam Altman's company. But comes in with this kind of interpersonal relationship between Elon Musk and Sam Altman that we've talked about so long.
You'll have to remind me, what is the state of affairs between them?
They are on an off-again relationship at the minute, I think. So it is difficult. Sometimes that might change by the minute or something like that. But they've been going on for 10 years now, argumenting about this sort of stuff, because they launched OpenAI together in 2015. They then disagreed on the future direction of it. They are now just complaining about each other. Musk was talking today on social media about the fact that OpenAI products are unfairly promoted by Apple in the App Store and saying that is not right, threatening an anti-competitive lawsuit. The reality is these two people are big titanic egos. They're always going to fight. We're always going to be interested in it. And so we'll continue talking about it.
Well, let's just mention that Elon Musk, is, as you say, talked to X this week to say that XAI is going to take legal action over Apple. And this is about, as you say, the App Store ranking system. Now, does this mean that his product just doesn't get a proper showing? It's not as prominent? What is it?
That's what he says, but the reality is that it does. And actually what's interesting is, you know, his complaints have been fact-checked by Grok, which is the AI chatbot that X has set up. And lots of people have been saying, well, actually, let's make sure whether or not this claim is true. And turns out that actually Grok disagrees with its master. So it says that Elon Musk is unjustified in this. He says that basically ChatGPT has sat at the top of App Store rankings for the last year plus, and that is not fair. Nobody else gets a look in. The reality is, of course, if we wind the clock back 7 months, we had DeepSeek, which was to the top of app stores around the world. We've also had Perplexity, which is that AI answer
engine. What's happened to DeepSeek?
That's still coming. There was rumours this week that actually they might be releasing a new version, although they have denied that. So usually there's no smoke without fire. They said that they're denying it's happening in the next 2 weeks by the end of the month. So I would imagine perhaps in September we might be talking about this.
Right, OK. And that would be, what, a more sophisticated, a sleeker version of DeepSeek?
Yeah, souped-up version of their model. So the first one was called R1, and that was kind of a big step change in the state-of-the-art technology for AI then. we believe that this is going to be an R2, which is just basically a bigger, stronger, faster version.
Okay. Now, more facial recognition vans. Now, we were talking earlier in the programme about an initiative from the police in Surrey. They were sending out undercover female police officers in jogging gear to just see what happened. And inevitably, they were catcalled. And then it led to, I think it was it pavement interventions? I think was what the inspector I spoke to explained happened. Basically, somebody would appear and say to the catcaller, "Listen, son, don't do that." And some education would then ensue. I wonder whether the facial recognition vans being rolled out across England are going to actually be effective. It's apparently an effort to locate suspects for crimes, including sexual offences, violent assaults and murders. So these are very serious crimes, obviously. How will these work?
Basically, 10 vans will be rolled out across the country, accessible to police forces, and they will be basically monitoring constantly at high-profile events. So we saw these rolled out recently at a Beyoncé concert where they actually managed to find a lot of people who were wanted by the police. The problem with this, of course, though, Jane, is that there are civil liberties issues. And I heard the police officer talking to you about these issues and the fact that he didn't actually arrest anybody and the kind of inability to call idiots when they are catcalling women, which is a bit unfortunate that he was unable to kind of go on the record with that. But I think these facial recognition systems are good in theory, but also a little bit problematic in practice. The argument against them is that it is kind of an incursion into our lives. Those who are in favour say, well, if you've got nothing to hide, then what's the problem? The problem, I suppose, is that it is yet another bit of data that we are giving up. And suddenly you start to be able to triangulate things here. So we know that a lot of these systems, unfortunately, they're not always as secure as we might hope. Now, no suggestions that these have been hacked or will be hacked at any point. But if you are a cyber criminal, I would suggest that might be a prime target for you. And suddenly then, if your face is given away, that's a big problem.
Chris, fantastic to have you with us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hope you get safely back to the cooler climes of the northeast of England. Now, let's hear more of what's happened in that call between European leaders and US President Donald Trump ahead of the Trump meeting with Putin on Friday. Let's rejoin the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, who's been speaking in the last couple of minutes, and his words are spoken through a translator.
We talked together with President Trump, and we will, under leadership of Macron and Starmer, we will continue our negotiations, our consultations within the coalition of the willing. That's part of an intensive dialogue that we had over the past weeks. We've had one-to-ones and we had various formats of talks in Alaska. Fundamental European and Ukrainian security interests need to be guaranteed. That was the message that us Europeans passed on to President Trump.
And here is President Zelensky of Ukraine.
We agreed on joint principles, on five principles. What concerns Ukraine must be discussed with Ukraine. We must support three-sided formats of the negotiations. There should be ceasefire, there should be security guarantees. President Trump said that he supports this and about America's readiness to take part. And Russia should not have the right of veto on Ukraine's NATO prospects, there should be joint pressure on Russia, there should be sanctions, and there should be message that if Russia doesn't agrees to ceasefire in Alaska, these principles should work.
The words of Ukraine's President Zelensky, spoken through a translator there. That meeting that took place this afternoon featuring the European leaders and Donald Trump in a call is now over. And there'll be much more with Callum MacDonald on Drive between 4 o'clock and 7 here on Times Radio. Now, after the headlines at 3:30, we've got that chunky conversation with Nicola Sturgeon. Her pretty unsparing memoir, frankly, is out tomorrow. Just listen to see how frank she's prepared to be after 3:30. Here are the headlines on Times Radio. Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Before he hosts Vladimir Putin on Friday, Donald Trump has been holding a call with European leaders. Within the last few minutes, the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz has said he's very happy President Volodymyr Zelensky could join him so they could do the video call with the leaders and the US president. He added European and Ukrainian security interests must be upheld in Alaska. President Zelensky said there should be a meeting with the three leaders, and he told Trump that he hopes the ceasefire will be the main topic in the Alaska talks. The prison sentence won't change for a teenager found guilty in June of killing elderly dog walker Bim Coley in a park in Leicestershire. The 80-year-old was punched, kicked and racially abused in Braunston Town last September. Judges dismissed a referral from the Attorney General, who'd argued the seven-year term for manslaughter wasn't long enough. The 15-year-old boy's team wanted it to come down, his Lady Justice Macker rejecting that.
The sentence was a very significant sentence, and necessarily so. It was entirely warranted by and commensurate with the seriousness of the offence. It is simply unarguable that the sentence was manifestly excessive or wrong in principle.
Three teenagers have been charged with murder and are expected to appear in court today following the death of a man in Kent. Alexander Cashford, who was 49, was found on the Isle of Sheppey on Sunday evening. And Labour MP Tulip Sadiq has called her corruption trial in Bangladesh a farce. The former city minister is accused of illegally obtaining land in the country's capital from her aunt. Remember, our news podcasts are on the Times Radio app. Look for the Times News Briefing and The World in 10.
This is Times Radio.
Play the opening game of Final One Standing by William Hill for your chance to win a share of £500,000 jackpot. It's free to play. Simply join the opening league before 12:30 on Saturday, 16th of August, and pick a team to win in the opening round. Then pick a team to win each week. You can only pick each team once, and if you're the final one standing, then the jackpot is yours. Final One Standing by William Hill. Football's ultimate elimination game. 18 plus online. Runs from 28th of July 2025. Price split if all players lose in the same round. Paid in 48 hours. T's and C's apply. Play responsibly.
You've reached the final level. The Spicy McNuggets side mission. Maximum flavour. Crispy crunch. And a spicy dip with a kick.
Are you ready?
Spicy McNuggets. For a limited time only. Until the 9th of September 25. Fees apply to delivery. Participation and price may vary. Subject to availability. Serving times apply.
Thanks to a blend of petrol and electric, fill up less this summer with the self-charging Mazda 2 Hybrid Centerline. It's available to finance for £199 per month with 0% APR representative. To go further for less this summer, search Mazda 2 Hybrid. Mazda Financial Services, PCP over 48 months, deposit of 5395, optional final payment of 9833. Indemnities may be required. Terms apply. See website.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
This is Times Radio.
And so to Nicola Sturgeon, whose memoir, frankly, is out tomorrow. Well, Nicola herself says she's had a torrid couple of years. And let's be honest, that could be an understatement. She'd been First Minister of Scotland and leader of the Scottish National Party between 2014 and 2023. Just a few days after she resigned, there was a knock on the door at 7 a.m. Her husband, Peter Murrell, the chief executive of the party, was arrested. He's still awaiting trial on embezzlement charges. Sturgeon herself was arrested in the June of 2023, but was told she faces no further action in March of this year. Here she is.
I mean, I've had a torrid couple of years and I probably don't need to go into too much detail about that because it's been played out all across the media. And, you know, it's been, again, without being sort of indulging in too much hyperbole here, it's been the toughest couple of years of my life with some really testing moments along the way. But I've emerged from it much stronger and actually much happier than I was before.
So it was 8 days after you resigned as First Minister that you got a rude awakening, 7 a.m, Scottish police force on your doorstep, and they arrested your husband. At that point, you, and I think this is very, it made me quite sad actually, you went to your mum and dad's.
I did. I mean, it wasn't my first instinct, maybe not strangely actually, it's probably quite a normal instinct. I suppose my first instinct was to protect them from what was happening. And I didn't really, in that moment, I didn't realise how ludicrous a notion that was, that there was no way I was going to be able to protect them because it was going to be headline, you know, almost global news within an hour or so. But I'd initially called my former chief of staff. She, as it turned out, had been at the gym, so she didn't answer the call. So I phoned my mum and dad, and with hindsight, I'm really glad that Liz hadn't answered the call, because I ended up probably in the only place that I really needed to be.
What did you say to them?
I remember phoning them very quickly, telling them what was unfolding. It was my mum I spoke to on the phone, and looking back on it, I'm not sure how she managed to stay as calm as she did. But then, you know, I just got in a car and I got there, and I was in a pretty bad state. I think I was in a state of shock, actually, more than anything else. So, you know, but my mum and dad did what my mum and dad have done and what good mum and dads do all the time. They just, metaphorically speaking, kind of put their arms around me and, you know, looked after me for, I think I was there for 2 or 3 days before I went home.
It's slightly difficult for us to talk in detail about what has happened, because your husband, Peter Morrell, is awaiting trial on charges of embezzlement. The most recent headlines around this case have been about the fact that he has got legal aid. And I think some people have asked questions about this, and it would seem to be pure coincidence that the fact he applied for legal aid occurred after you'd announced your separation, and therefore your own assets couldn't be included?
I can't answer questions that, because I'm not party to the application he made or the decision making around that. And, you know, that's just how things are. Peter and I were together for a long time, but our marriage is over, and it had been over for quite a bit of time before I think we found, or I found, the kind of strength to announce it publicly. And that's just how things are. It's not the easiest situation to have that running in parallel to the end of a marriage, and there are all sorts of complications around that, but that is the situation that I am in.
Are you divorced?
We're not divorced yet. No, divorce takes longer. We are separated, and we will be, you know, going through that process.
But he is still awaiting the date of his trial?
Yes.
What was so interesting about this book, and by the way, it's a we don't want to spend a lot of time dwelling on negative aspects of your life and times, because what an achievement. I mean, you call yourself a slightly awkward, shy girl from Ayrshire, but it does seem that the behaviour of men, to one point or another, depending on the men involved, has somewhat overshadowed your achievements. What would you say about that?
Do you know, I take responsibility for my own decisions, my own actions, my own relationships. And in writing a book about my life, it was impossible not to reflect, albeit with the limitations and constraints you speak about, on what we've just been talking about, but also on, you know, the breakdown of a relationship with another really important man in my life, my predecessor as SNP leader.
This is Alex Salmond.
Alex Salmond. And, yeah, I mean, those relationships, and obviously I'm not going to go into any more detail about my husband for the reasons we understand, but, you know, my relationship with Alex Salmond had many, many, many ups and many things that I look back fondly on, but it broke down in a situation where he was faced with certain allegations, and that was really difficult. And as a result of that, and people can make their own judgments about, you know, how right or wrong this was, you know, I then was subject to, you know, a parliamentary investigation, an independent investigation into my conduct. And
So would you say, and it might be difficult, that the behaviour of these men, they have tarnished your legacy?
Those relationships have been difficult, and the circumstances of them have been difficult. But I take the view, and it's a choice I'm making, and I try to do this in my book. I'm responsible. I don't particularly like the word legacy. It sounds awful grand, but I'm responsible for how people see me and how I have and continue to conduct myself, and that's what I'm going to try to do. I'm proud. I mean, I've made a ton of mistakes, as any leading politician in office for as long as I was in office will have done. I've made a ton of mistakes, but I've done lots of things I'm really proud of, and that's what I choose to focus on.
Well, I must say that you are hard on yourself in this book. At the times you talk about, you misjudged the mood in the room, you got speeches wrong, you thought yourself flat-footed, you acknowledge that you've got an ego. Your friends say you're actually much funnier in real life than you allow yourself to be in your public life.
I should say the funnier in private than in public is, or even vice versa, is not a high bar, but there you go.
But I mean, I've read a few books by male politicians. I don't think they're this hard on themselves. Did you set out to be?
I set out to try to be, I was about to say frank, obviously the title of the memoir is frankly, but that's deliberate. I set out to try to give an honest account of, you know, what I consider to be my achievements and successes. And I think there are many of them, and I hope they come across in the book as well. But not to shy away from or be defensive about the things I got wrong. But I think I've come to the conclusion that it's a better way to be than what some, naming no names, kind of former prime ministers or whatever is admit no fault at all.
That's a theme of the book, that men, male politicians in particular, get away with behaviour that no woman in public life could ever get away with, and loads of women will be fully behind you there and absolutely acknowledging it every step of the way. I mean, Alex Salmond, there were signs this bloke was wrong and long, long ago. I mean, you say yourself, he wasn't a details man, he was a wing-it merchant, and he was quite
fantastic.
He was
also brilliant. One of the things about Alec, I've tried, and obviously he's no longer here to speak for himself, and that has also been something I had to think carefully about how I portrayed him in a book when he's no longer here. But I've tried not to rewrite history. He was my mentor. He was a very close friend. It's for others to judge, but I would say we were one of the most successful political partnerships in recent British political history. So a lot of my successes, not all of them, but a lot of them, he is integrally involved in and you know, deserves the credit as much as I do. But he was a tough person to work for. That's not a fault in itself. And particularly in our years in government, he would sometimes leave the heavy lifting of government.
Well, he left the heavy lifting to you. That was
on aspects of the referendum, the independence white paper. The story you tell is just in the run up to us publishing the white paper, which getting that to the point of publication was a mammoth task. Almost broke me at times. And a particular point of contention between us was that he decided to go off on a trip to China just in the few weeks before it was due to go to print, having not really read it or engaged with it. And then, yeah, I was about to stand in for him at First Minister's Questions, and he phoned me, having just spent the afternoon at horse racing in Hong Kong, I think. He'd had a few.
Well, you just put the phone down on him, didn't you?
I was about to go into the Chamber of Parliament to literally stand in for him at First Minister's Questions, and he was telling me, you know, giving me help, what he would have thought. And, you know, at times this was an amusing side of his personality. Well, I wasn't amused that day.
Much less amusing when he came to tell you that he'd been accused of sexual harassment and indeed, offences much worse than that. Were you surprised, genuinely?
Yes.
Why?
Because I had never, people have, I've questioned this about myself so much and so deeply over the years. How could I have been surprised? You know, there had been many rumours. I mean, Alec was a tough person to work for. He was never particularly rough on me. We tended to be had more of a relationship of equals, but I'd seen him, you know, be really, really rough on people that worked for him. I'd intervened at times. You know, some people...
Can you define rough? I mean, most of us haven't been in these meetings.
I don't want to make comparisons between the two individuals, but, you know, when people talk about hairdryer treatment when they're talking about somebody I think highly of, Sir Alec Ferguson, that kind of thing, just dressing people down overly harshly in public, you know, to the point of trying to kind of humiliate them, you know, really fixing people with kind of like death stares, that kind of stuff. And I had stepped in on a few occasions. So there had been that kind of behaviour. And I think those of us who had worked a long, long time with Alec, I'd worked with Alec since I was a teenager, had become over the years quite inured to that. So when we went into government for the first time and a civil service was suddenly exposed to it, I think they saw it differently to how we had come to see it. So there was that I was aware of. There had also been periodic rumours of affairs, you know, which, you know, but not anything that wasn't consensual. And I always took the view that that was his business. You know, what consenting adults get up to is not my business. If it had started to impinge on what we were doing as a party, as a government, I may have raised it with them, but I never felt the need to do that. So I had been aware of that, but any suggestion of what actually transpired, Yes, well, I had not over the years had any reason to suspect that.
You say in the book that he effectively admitted the substance of one of the complaints against
him. Yeah, I mean, that's my description. I should say, in fairness to him, he always vehemently denied that he'd done anything wrong.
Well, both can't be true. Yeah, well, he admitted the substance and denied he'd done anything wrong.
No, I think what I'm saying is what the account he gave me of one of the incidents seemed to me to be effectively admitting it, but he would be like, well, it was a misunderstanding, I didn't do anything wrong. So there was a sense on his part that it was all kind of just, it could be explained away, whereas in describing it to me, it just seemed to me he was describing something that was deeply, deeply inappropriate.
Doesn't it infuriate you that actually in a memoir you've written about your life, we are actually having to focus on this?
Yeah, I mean, look, the whole thing infuriated me, upset me deeply at the time. This guy had been so close to him, mainly professionally, but, you know, in politics, those professional relationships inevitably become personal because you spend so much time with somebody. It was deeply upsetting. I suddenly lost a relationship that had been so important to me. I think I used this phrase in the book. I kind of went through what I can only describe as a grieving process for him. So it upset me, it infuriated me. And then, of course, I found myself, you know, interrogated in front of parliamentary committees about what I knew when. And that felt to me at the time, and it still feels to me, at an intellectual level and at the level of a politician who accepts scrutiny, whether it feels fair or not, I got it. But at a very human level, it felt so deeply, deeply unfair that I had to go through that. And it still, to some extent, does.
Now, you are very, very honest in the book about things that have happened to you. And I really was struck by the detailed account of your miscarriage. Now, I mean, I think it's fair to say that if you've never had a miscarriage, you might think it's nothing. But anyone who has had one knows literally bloody awful. And you put it out there. It's did you consider not discussing it?
I think the miscarriage happened at the end of 2010, just over New Year 2010 into 2011. It was, I think, about 2015 or thereabouts before I first even acknowledged it publicly. I have been asked, as many women, childless women in public roles will have been for time immemorial, it felt to me almost in every kind of interview that had any personal element to it, I was asked the question, are you going to have children? When are you going to have children? And then the older I got, why have you not had children? Incidentally, going back to Alex Salmond, he didn't have children.
No,
I'm not aware of
him
ever been asked that question.
No.
And so I got to a point where it was becoming uncomfortable to constantly be asked. And also the assumptions that were made that somebody like me, senior politician, first minister of my country, that I'd made at some point some hard-hearted, cold, ruthless decision to not have kids for the sake of my career.
Yeah.
And I suppose what I wanted to say, using my own experience, was that there's lots of different reasons why a woman might not have children, and there will be different reasons at different points of their life.
Sure.
There have been parts of my life where I didn't want to have kids. There have been other times where I did and, as it turned out, couldn't. So I guess I just wanted to say, don't make assumptions about people.
No. You also say, and again, I think this is so honest, that you were ambivalent about the pregnancy, and that haunts you to a degree.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I got, without going into too much detail, I got pregnant quicker than I thought I would. And so when I realised I was pregnant, I quickly worked out that I was going to be 6 months pregnant during an election campaign, you know, the 2011 Scott, which would be the SNP seeking our second term in office. I was the Deputy First Minister. It seems a bit odd now, but even back then, it's only, you know, what, 15
yeah,
years
different.
Ago. And that was before you'd had senior Jacinda Ardern and people like that having children in office. I didn't really know what the public reaction would be. And so I was really, really stressed about that. Was I jeopardising the party's chances? Was I jeopardising my own chances? Would I be able to cope? Election campaigns are pretty grueling. You know, even if I sailed through the pregnancy, would it be okay? What if I didn't? What if I had terrible morning sickness? So I had this deep ambivalence. And at times, and this is the thing that haunts me most, I think, in light of what happened, there were days where I privately, because I didn't tell anybody else this, I wished I wasn't pregnant. And then when I had the miscarriage, I felt, and I know this is so irrational, but I kind of felt I was being punished for the days when I'd sort of wished that I wasn't.
I think, honestly, I think any person who's been through that experience will have huge sympathy for you there, genuinely, because it's just not a rational process. It really isn't. So I absolutely acknowledge that. You also talk in the book about the rumour about you and, was it a French, was she a foreign politician?
She was a French ambassador at the time. She later became the French foreign minister.
Right. And the rumour was you were having an affair with her. And you say it's just, you know, load of rubbish. It wasn't true.
I think when this rumour started, I think I'd maybe met her once. In fact, I'm not even sure I had met her when the rumour first started.
Well, you can still have an affair even if you haven't met them.
I take your word for that, Jane.
You acknowledge that the rumour was out there. You say it wasn't true. And then you say you've never considered sexuality, your own included, to be binary. Mm. Now, people are going to look at that sentence, as in fact I have, and ponder on it. So what are you telling us?
I'm not making any great revelation. I'm not sticking any labels on it. I guess what I'm saying is that's how I see the world. And it would have been dishonest to say it's how I see the world in relation to other people, but not in relation to myself. And I don't think sexuality is binary.
So genuinely, and I agree with you, lots of people would be absolutely on board with this. You could fall for a woman or a man, and you believe everyone could, or most people could.
I believe that, yeah, that's how I see life and the world, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's just talk briefly, if we can, about the men, the political mega-beasts like Donald Trump, Boris Johnson, the way they conduct themselves. And as we speak on this day, John Swinney, the current Scottish First Minister, is apparently getting on really well with Donald Trump. How would you have played that?
I never had to do it. I mean, I give an account in the book of a phone conversation I had with him, which was bad enough. So I'm probably quite relieved I didn't have to do more than that. I should say there are many, many, many really decent guys in politics, and John Swinney is an example of that.
Weirdly, I just wanted to acknowledge the three men you really liked: David Cameron, Martin McGuinness, Prince Philip. Let's just put that out there.
I'm not sure I said I really, really like David Cameron. I mean, these things are all relative. I think with Donald Trump, what I would say, this is the approach I took with Boris Johnson, is just try to be yourself and stand your ground and not be bullied. I suspect Boris and Trump are not exactly the same in how they approach these things. Superficially, they might be. But it's all about using the kind of power of their personality, what they would see as charisma, I have to say I don't, to kind of override everybody else in the room and be the loudest voice and the most dominant figure. And I think it's really easy, probably particularly for women, to kind of get quite cowed by that. So my approach would be stand your ground, be yourself, and just don't let yourself be bullied. And people have asked me a lot about Boris. What's he like in private, basically? And the answer is exactly the same as he appears in public. You know, and I think that's the case for Trump. What you see in public is kind of how, well, on the evidence of that phone call, how he is in private. It's just a stream of consciousness, effectively, about how great he is. That's what it was.
Yeah, and often it seems to me, and I'm sure to other observers, that we've totally given up calling this out. He's taken really seriously. And there is, I mean, we've said it before, we'll say it again, no woman who conducts herself like that would be taken as seriously.
No, and I sort of use the example of Theresa May. Again, you know, Theresa and I are poles apart politically. But as an example of somebody who took her job seriously, took public service seriously, who was always ultra, you know, briefed on everything, I had an enormous amount of respect for her. And yet she was effectively ousted by Johnson. And if she or any female politician turned up looking like he does, you know, he dishevels his hair kind of deliberately before interviews, or as unprepared as he is. And I've been in private meetings with him, you know, during COVID, for example, almost, you know, hard to think of a more serious subject matter, when he would genuinely be completely unprepared. No grasp of detail whatsoever. No woman in politics would last 5 minutes with that approach. And yet we normalise it. with men. And I think over the last couple of years, we are normalising it more and more and more, that that is becoming the model of a successful politician. And I think that is deeply concerning in terms of, I mean, strip aside party politics, anybody who cares about democracy, I think that is of deep and profound concern.
Obviously, your whole political career has been built around the dream of Scottish independence. Would it be unfair to say you probably, and perhaps the conduct of some people within your party, has actually brought that prospect further away?
No,
Made it less likely?
I don't. I think independence, and, you know, you can say to me, I would say this because I'm a politician who believes in it, but I think Scotland will become independent. I can't sit here right now and give you a date for that or a time scale. But I think if you look at just Scotland to start with, the demographics of support for independence are striking. You know, under 35s overwhelmingly support independence.
But I put it to you, and you know, the rise of reform in Scotland is really interesting. I mean, the latest poll I could find said they're polling at 19%, which is the same as Labour in the Scottish parliamentary election.
So I'm not... You know, I'm not going to be contesting another election, but I'm really concerned about the rise of reform. And I think, and this would be, I guess, if I can offer any advice to those who are still in the fray of politics in Scotland, is there needs to be more than a rhetorical sort of riposte to reform in Nigel Farage. There needs to be a substantive response from, you know, progressive politicians, reformers speaking to a constituency of people who are not seeing the answers to the problems they perceive in more mainstream politicians. And I think that's a concern for all of us, again, without being complacent, because I think it does pose a challenge for my party too. But I think it is probably Labour that is suffering more electorally, or may suffer more electorally from that in Scotland. But, you know, it's a challenge for democracy more generally.
That is Nicola Sturgeon. It's Times Radio, 3 minutes to four.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing, with intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
The road stretches before you, but there's trouble ahead. Stationary cars. You're faced with a McDonald's side mission. Do you, A, join the ever-growing queue, or B, take the next exit and treat yourself to a glorious Mackey's?
Detouring to McDonald's.
Start your side mission today.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
As a small business owner, you've got to be ready for the ups and the downs. Ready to think on your feet, ready to be rushed off your feet, ready to make the big decisions and make the tea. Two sugars in mind? Ta. Ready to be there for your customers whenever they need you. Well, ditto. Virgin Media Broadband's ready for anything business can throw at it. Yeah, it's business-ready broadband. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband.
This is Times Radio.
So Nicola Sturgeon's memoir, frankly, is out now. Actually, I've got another Scottish guest on the programme tomorrow. It's writer Val McDermid, joins us at around about 3:30 tomorrow afternoon. Thank you very much for listening. The podcast Off Air with Jane and Fee is this week Off Air with Jane and Jane, Mark Herrins, that is. And there will be a longer version of the Nicola Sturgeon in the pod, which drops at around 6 o'clock tonight. Producer today was Kia Browning, and the technical operator was Ryan Boyden. And Callum McDonald is next with Drive. Have a good evening.
across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. Hello, good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. This is Callum MacDonald in for John Pienaar. Welcome to Times Radio Drive. The headlines: NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte says the ball is now in Putin's court as Western leaders emphasise to President Trump that a ceasefire must come before any peace agreement for Ukraine. And the Times exclusively reveals that US envoy Steve Witkoff is understood to support the idea of a West Bank-style occupation of Ukraine. Coming up in the programme, European leaders, the Ukrainian President and President Trump finish their discussions, and Europe talks of recognition of land captured by Russia, saying it cannot happen. We'll hear from our experts today, the Times World Affairs editor Catherine Phil, the UK's former defence attaché to Moscow and Kyiv, and a former Ukrainian diplomat, and many, many more.
This is Times Radio.
First this afternoon, let's get the latest news. Here's Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has said Donald Trump supported us today and the US is ready to continue that support following a call with the US President and European leaders. The virtual talks come ahead of Trump's meeting with Vladimir Putin in Alaska on Friday. It's understood a coalition of the willing meeting is now taking place. Times World Affairs editor Catherine Philp explains some of the concerns the leaders will have.
The notion that this is a listening exercise for Trump is, I think, alarming to everyone in Europe and certainly here in Ukraine, because it suggests that Trump is going to make himself available to Kremlin talking points once again.
Downing Street has said our support for Ukraine is unwavering. International borders must not be changed by force, and Ukraine must have robust and credible security guarantees to defend its territorial integrity. Meanwhile, the Times understands that Russia and the United States have discussed Israel's occupation of the West Bank as a model for ending the war in Ukraine. Under the scenario, Russia would have military and economic control of occupied Ukraine under its own governing body. The idea was raised weeks ago in discussions between Steve Witkoff, President Trump's peace envoy, and his Russian counterparts, according to a source close to the US National Security Council. A teenager who was convicted of killing pensioner Bim Coley in a park in Leicestershire won't have his sentence increased. Judges at the Court of Appeal said the 15-year-old's seven-year term for manslaughter wasn't too lenient. A Syrian man has been charged with assault and sexual assault after police were called to a hotel housing asylum seekers in Essex. 32-year-old Mohammed Shawak, staying at the Bell Hotel in Epping, has been remanded in custody. Allegations date between the 25th of July and the 12th of August. 10 new facial recognition police vans will soon be deployed on the streets of England and Wales. They've been used already in London and South Wales to scan faces that walk past and check against a list of wanted suspects. On Times Radio, Policing Crime Minister Dame Diana Johnson insisted the technology doesn't violate human rights or data protection laws, but Head of Research and Investigations at Big Brother Watch, Jake Herford, has criticised the government for not going through Parliament first.
Police in South Wales and Cardiff trialled it across the entire city centre during a Six Nations rugby match, and it's a step further than CCTV because at least someone has to go through that and justify it. But this is performing an ID check, it's an entire street or entire city at once, and that's something I think is way too intrusive for a Western democratic country. Nowhere else in the West, in a democratic nation, uses this kind of surveillance on this kind of scale.
And these words from US Vice President last week might ring a bell.
We've gone fishing in the lake outside, and unfortunately, the one strain on the special relationship is that all of my kids caught a fish, but the Foreign Secretary did not. I'm sorry.
It turns out something else David Lammy didn't have was the right to license to go rod fishing with the US Vice President on his Kent estate on Friday. The Foreign Secretary has referred himself to the Environment Agency and has since brought the correct permit, calling it an admin oversight. Remember, our news podcast on the Times Radio app. Look for the Times News Briefing and the World in 10.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and via your smart speaker.
Times Radio Drive with Barclays Business Banking.
Hello, good afternoon. It's 4 minutes past four on Wednesday afternoon, the 13th of August. Welcome to Times Radio Drive. This is Callum MacDonald here while John Pienaar is on holiday. If your broadband slowed down this afternoon, it's probably because of the weight of the virtual summits which have taken place between European leaders and the President of the United States. Donald Trump posted earlier that European leaders are great people who want to see a deal done. But is his vision for a deal with Russia to progress towards peace in Ukraine the same as those great people of Europe? These calls are not routine check-ins, of course. They're part of a concerted push to try to realign positions, indeed for Europe to influence Trump before the Alaska summit, where the presidents of the US and Russia will meet face-to-face in what could be one of the most consequential gatherings in memory, actually. For Europe, the calls with Trump today are a moment to gauge his tone, his intent, to understand whether his public optimism matches what he is planning in private. They're assessing what their one voice will say on land swaps, on a ceasefire, and indeed on the sly tactics of Putin, the invader. For Trump, these calls are another stage to project his steadfast determination that he is the dealmaker and that he can get Vladimir Putin to work towards peace. We'll explore what's at stake at the Alaska summit, and we'll consider how today's international strategizing will shape the conversation on Friday. Diplomacy at its core is not about hashtags or indeed headlines. It's about the choices made when perhaps no one is watching. And those choices are being made this afternoon. Welcome to Times Radio Drive. I'm Callum MacDonald. Also coming up on the programme, the crisis at universities is brought into focus again as language classes are merged. And Nicola Sturgeon tells Times Radio of the differing standards for male and female politicians, though all political careers end in failure, don't they? You can text us. The number is 87222. Start your message with the word Times, or you can WhatsApp us. The number is 033-003-2353. Our top story, talks have concluded between President Trump and European leaders ahead of the Alaska summit on Friday. President Zelensky of Ukraine says he hopes a ceasefire will be a central theme of the meeting, but maintains something of a realistic outlook. Here he is, speaking through an interpreter.
I told the US President and all our European colleagues that Putin is bluffing. He is trying to push forward along the whole front. And Putin is also bluffing, saying that he doesn't care about the sanctions and that they're not working. In reality, the sanctions are very effective and they're hurting the Russian military economy.
The German Chancellor Friedrich Merz says Ukraine must be involved in negotiations from here on out.
The American president knows if the United States of America now work towards a peace that keeps Ukrainian European interests in mind as well, then he can expect our full support and can count on it. We made various things clear for the negotiations. We made it clear that Ukraine has to be at the table if there are any follow-up meetings.
Well, let's go straight to Catherine Philp, World Affairs Editor for The Times. Hello, Catherine.
Hi, Callum.
What have we learned then about these calls, about what's been discussed, and I suppose if we've got any sense of the direction these talks on Friday are now going to take?
Well, we've only heard really from one side so far. We've heard from Zelensky and Merz representing the European